Thanks for that. So I thought I'd begin this talk by putting up these quotes that I found in an ABC article about invisible work that was written last year. And I chose to include them because I think they really encapsulate what this talk will be about. What has changed for women in the last 50 years and what has stayed the same? Because on the one hand, both women mention that they have their own serious careers. One of them says she earns the majority of the income in her household. But on the other hand, they both say they do the lion's share of the work in the home, the mundane yet essential tasks that everyone relies on in order to continue functioning. And they're both clearly dissatisfied with their lot, both pretty pissed off, I reckon you could say. And in this talk, I'll discuss how the situation for working class women overall has changed, gotten better and gotten worse, and why we need a radical movement for women's rights today that is connected to the struggle for workers' rights. And we need to fight to overthrow capitalism as a whole to achieve liberation. And that sounds like a pretty big task. And that's why we need to analyze women's oppression. What drives it? Where's it coming from? So that we can attack it at the root. So firstly, what has changed for women? A bit of a snapshot. The world today for women is vastly different to those of like our grandparents' generation, I think is pretty unquestionable. In the early 1960s, all kinds of inequality was actually formally enshrined in law, as well as normalized in attitudes amongst the general population. Women's wages were set at 85% of men's wages. It was just normal that you'd have to leave your job in the public service if you got married. And my grandmother did that. She was just very normal. That's what you did when you got married. Divorce was stigmatized, restricted. You know, there was no such thing as like no fault divorce, just being able to separate in an amicable kind of way. You had to prove like breakdowns of marriage and so on. Abortion was illegal, very difficult to access as well, backyard abortions and so on. And women couldn't get things like a bank loan or their own like bank accounts without a male guarantor. In mainstream popular culture, it was just normal, these kinds of representations of women, that women's most important role is in the home, that the thing that we really love to do is create an environment of domestic bliss for our husbands and our children. And in stark contrast, women are a big part of the workforce today, make up almost half of the paid workforce in Australia in 2020, compared to around 30% in 1966. And social attitudes have also advanced. No one thinks it's appropriate to expect women to be the sole homemakers anymore. Instead, the representation of women in the media, advertising and popular culture encourages us to be seen and aspire to be seen as attractive to men, sexually available to them at all times. Abortions are accessible in every state in Australia. They're harder to access if you live outside a capital city. And formal equal pay, the right to formal equal pay before the law, all these kinds of rights have been established. Another change that has occurred alongside this is that a lot of care work is actually now done in the formal economy. Not that long ago, households were split. One parent, almost always the man, would be outside of home, working outside of home, generating the income and so on. And one parent, almost always the woman, cared for the kids, got dinner on the table. And it was kind of just enough. This single income was just enough to buy your home in the suburbs. But now almost everyone works outside of the home, but the housework still needs to get done. And accompanying women's like entrance into the workforce to have, be able to work full time in a high powered job. A lot of domestic labor has been marketized, as in done by low paid women in the formal economy, no longer privatized in the home. So there's been massive growth in the sectors of childcare, aged care, food preparation, takeaway food, domestic cleaning, and so on. And on the one hand, it's positive that more women are more prominent and more powerful. This affects social attitudes and consciousness about women's place in society. but this hasn't been enabled by the capitalist taking a hit, the capitalist like coughing up to pay for this. But low paid working class women are now forced to bear the burden, which continues to reinforce the sexist ideas around care and domestic labor being women's work that is essentially inferior and less deserving of decent wages. And of course, a lot of women still take on a lot of unpaid care at home that I'll go on to describe as well. Another very visible change is the increasing representation of women at the top of society in the like 1% in the top rungs. There's more women CEOs and boards of directors than ever before. And in fact, we've had our first women prime minister, you know, woo. And in fact, for a long time now, the richest person in Australia has been this slug, Gina Rinehart. Who last year, a real girl boss, it could be said, she's worth herself a whopping $34 billion. And that is up $3 billion in the last year alone of the pandemic. So we've seen the commodity price skyrocketing and so on, and she's making bank off it. But the lives of women in general today are far from free and fully liberated. And more than ever before, women face the double burden of working for a low-paid job and doing the majority of care for family members in the home. And so one of the key places where women's oppression is played out and reinforced is in the family. And in Australia, women continue to perform more than their fair share of unpaid domestic labour. Over 64% of their work week is unpaid. And the monetary value of this unpaid care work is actually staggering. If you actually paid women for the work that they do in the home each year in Australia, it would add up to $650 billion, which is actually just over half of Australia's gross domestic product. It is literally half the economy. So without this unpaid labor, our economy couldn't function, and yet economists don't include it in any kind of accounting or anything. And if it was paid, this kind of childcare would be Australia's largest industry, larger than any other in the formal economy. It would just absolutely dwarf, you know, what's seen as Australia's biggest exports. And 3/4 of it would be performed by women, according to PwC analysis. So 64% of a woman's week is unpaid, while for men it's just 36%. And another like metaphor to get your head around this is that's the equivalent of having a full-time job where you're only paid up to 3 p.m. on a Tuesday. The rest of your work week is just unpaid labor in the home. And a report by Treasury economists last month stated that women experience a drop in their income after having children of up to 55%. Like, that is staggering. Look at that graph. It's despicable. And this motherhood penalty persists for even a decade. And if you can read the print from that article there, even among women who, you know, try to return to the workforce, back to the workplace as soon as possible, their incomes are still down by 5% versus, you can see, yeah, the wages of men virtually untouched. And for many couples, especially heterosexual ones, it makes financial sense for the man to stay at work as his salary is typically higher. No matter your feminist principles, it just makes economic sense to do that. But taking time out of the workforce to care for children or other family members can permanently lower career prospects and earnings later on for women, continuing to reinforce women's unequal status at work. And what is the impact of this massive amount of unpaid domestic work that I've talked about? First up, it takes the burden off the capitalists, the 1% who are raking in profits off our labor, to pay up and provide decent childcare and family care so that women don't have to do this, you know, care by ourselves and unpaid. It's incredibly cost saving for the business class that the essential work of literally keeping people alive to go back to work the next day, that this reproduction of the labor force is taken on as a private burden by workers. And it also serves an ideological purpose, reinforcing the idea that women's paid jobs are just still actually secondary to their primary responsibility and supposedly natural inclination to care for others in the family. We're just born ready to birth babies, you know, feed them. We have some kind of genetic aptitude that just makes us better at stacking plates and dishwashers or something like that. And it reduces the earning capacity and financial independence of women in the immediate and in the long term, again, reinforcing the undervalued nature of women's work. And the workplace also impacts back on the home back on your supposedly private decisions. Your workplace and your job influences where and how you can afford to live, how much free time you have. Your income will shape what you can afford to do in that free time, and in, you know, much larger decisions that people usually make in their own personal lives as well. How many children you want to have, whether a full-time wage and whose wage will be given up to do unpaid caring for the children, and so on. And the world of work narrows the choices for working class women and men. And at work, women are systematically disadvantaged. Figures from November 2021 put the gender pay gap at 13.8%, which translates to a difference of $255 each week for full-time work. And women, of course, disproportionately work in casual and part-time work, as that is often work you can do around all of your work in the home. And when you include part-time work, the total earnings gap widens to 30.6%, which is a difference of $483 each week. And all of this affects the self-confidence, the economic independence, the personal choices, and the standard of living for the majority of people in Australia today. And it provides a backdrop against which sexist ideas are formed and reinforced. So oppression in the home undermines women as they go out into the workforce, and unequal treatment at their jobs also serves to reinforce their unequal role at home. And the workplace and the family are the two central pillars of women's oppression, and neither have decreased in significance in society over the decades, because the economy continues to run off exploiting workers, and bosses continue to benefit tremendously from the privatized work that millions of women and people take on for themselves at home, cooking and cleaning and raising the next generation of workers. And this material reality is important, and it must be our starting point. So one popular understanding of oppression today is that it is largely a result of like derogatory attitudes, language, negative attitudes towards particular groups, and that it most egregiously affects minorities who are largely misunderstood or marginalized from mainstream society. And this kind of liberal perspective and framework gets so much wrong. First of all, two of the most important oppressed groups in capitalism today, workers and women, are not minorities at all. And their oppression is all the more important and acute because of this. Both groups are vital to keeping the capitalist system ticking over, and therefore substantial economic, you know, social, cultural resources are invested in keeping them in their place and ensuring that they continue to fulfill their subordinate social and economic role. There's no way that capitalism could run smoothly while women and workers are totally marginalized, excluded from public life, and given no rights or freedoms at all. Who the hell would do all the work each day that produces the capitalist profits if this was so? And who would take on the burden of family caring so that bosses don't have to pay for it? So focusing on marginalization and taking it as the benchmark of whether you're oppressed or not makes no sense. I think it makes, instead, it's better to see that while women are not totally disenfranchised, not totally kept out of paid work, like other groups can be, or like more women experienced in the past, their oppression today is real and integral to the functioning of capitalism. And it is a totalizing oppression. It shapes everything women think and feel about themselves. And it is, in fact, a bad thing for women to think that they are not oppressed. Because then you might think that the bullshit that we put up with is just, you know, that's just how it is. That's as good as it's going to get, and we'd better shut up about it. And that's not right. There's a lot more that we need to fight for. Thinking women have achieved real equality is incorrect. But even in the limited spheres where women are more on a more level playing field with men, the dynamic of class still dominates. The increasing amount of girl boss billionaires does nothing for working class women. Equal right to be exploited by a boss, make their profits, and get none of the control over society or over your own life is no equality at all. And assuming that working class women aren't oppressed anymore is an obstacle and a barrier to understanding how to develop, to developing consciousness about the role and function of oppression and understanding how capitalism works. And this in turn can get in the way of more people waking up to the injustices of capitalism today, more people wanting to organize against it and fight effectively for their liberation. So it is vital for us to understand what oppression is, a phenomenon that has its roots in the underlying economic functioning and social institutions of capitalism. And that affects social relations in all sorts of obvious and more subtle ways. And the oppression of those who labor is the most crucial of all. Capitalism needs oppression of all kinds to keep running. And by definition, it is based on the minority rule of a tiny class of parasites who don't work and contribute nothing meaningful to society. And these scum, they don't just have all the money, they own and control all of the means of production, all of the most important productive instruments, the factories, the farms, and so on. And they decide what gets produced, how it gets produced, where it goes, what it's made of, how it gets disposed of, what price it sells for on the market, and so on. And so they decide how every workplace is run. And the majority of the human race don't control the means of production and therefore can't work for themselves. Instead, we're forced to sell our labor to survive. And we get paid a fraction of the value we actually make each day for the bosses. And they pocket the rest of it as profit to buy their second yacht and their seventh house and to reinvest in their business, to buy the next store or buy the next labor-saving kind of bit of machinery so that they can ramp up productivity and make even more profits to outcompete their rivals. So this vast, anarchic and obscenely unequal system needs ways to make all of us accept this blatantly unfair state of affairs. And for exploitation to continue, the capitalists need to ensure that the majority have their rights curtailed, their lives controlled, their creativity stunted, and their sense of self-worth diminished. And so the way your workplace is organized is primarily around pumping up profits, not to make the social process of work fulfilling or satisfying in any way. And basic things like safety just fall by the wayside. For most people, their job is boring and a source of frustration and pain. But even if your job was really exciting, the everyday experience of submitting to a boss and having to work for them for a wage to live is deadening and draining. The majority of workers have very little say over when they show up to work, what they wear at work, you know, when they get to take a break, and so on. And so much for capitalism being a society of freedom and choice. And this is all before you get to the points about the role of outright violent repression in this system, in the form of cops attacking picket lines and protests when people try to resist their oppression. Capitalism also keeps people in their place by undermining workers' self-confidence and reinforcing the idea that this is the natural way of things, nothing can be done, this is just how humans be. And by sheer economic coercion, workers can be compelled to accept pitiful wages because your measly income could be taken from you if you fight back. And all the capitalists, the bosses, the politicians who serve them, they're always already shoving their crap ideas in our heads through their mouthpieces, through the media, through the schooling system, and so on. So we're conditioned to accept this situation, or at least resign ourselves to it. Capitalists promote as well the ideas of personal salvation through your, you know, just having a really nice family life, or, you know, look inwards and really explore yourself, you know, really, really get to grips with who you are inside. And that's a, you know, obsess over every facet of your inner self. That's a way that they encourage us to push our heads down, you know, keep your heads down, not kick up a fuss. Focusing on yourself is all you can do with the shit hands you've been dealt. And don't worry about who's dealing the deck. So a united working class is something that could pose a real threat to the capitalists, and our struggle therefore threatens the stability of their system. So they must do all they can to stifle, block, and otherwise restrict our capacity to organize. And in this sick system, women's oppression is capitalism is not just one amongst others, just another subset or another like intersection, but it is absolutely vital. It is central to the functioning of the system. And it serves to both intensify the oppression of the working class, because women are a large and particularly underpaid section of the working class, and maintain the social stability needed to ensure a steady supply of workers to be exploited. Materially, the bosses need future workers to be cared for from infancy to adulthood, so that they're physically and mentally ready to work, as well as educated, trained in certain skills to meet the boss's changing demands. And that is the key role of the family. And the family is where all workers begin, begin their lives, begin their socialization in the ideas of capitalism. To accept the authority of your parents, respect the rules, to learn your place, that is where gender socialization begins. Like, who else teaches you? You've got to shave your legs if you're a girl or whatever, and so on. It's your mother. And despite the family increasingly including single parents and same-sex parents, it remains the key institution that reproduces the labor force at little cost to the capitalists, and it continues to rely on the unpaid work and oppression of women. And their oppression continues to undermine the confidence, aspirations, and participation of women. So laying all this out, I think you have to see that the structural problem of unpaid labor in the home and unequal pay is not something that individual women can solve on their own. You can't like self-care your way out of this situation. But it's politically important that women are conscious of their oppression and conscious of their power as workers, and have a desire to live in an equal society and don't want to be lumped with the domestic chores while getting underpaid at work. And this is, I think, a crucial point to have this as our framework. Women has, as part of the workforce, women have a social power that they do not possess as wives and mothers, and can take an active part in their own liberation and that of their class. The two go together. And this focus on women as workers with power rather than as passive victims is one of the key differences between the Marxist and the feminist approach, and underlies any genuinely revolutionary approach to the struggle for liberation. So to start summing up, the social movements that took off in the 1960s and 70s transformed all aspects of Australian life. You know, the laws and regulations, public opinion, corporate attitudes, all of these today look nothing like they did in the past. And these changes were not achieved by heroic individuals or especially passionate pleas to those at the top of society, but by the power of collective movements, activists, unionists, militants working together in the fight. And it's no coincidence that when you look back through history, the most gains made for women's liberation, gay liberation, steps forward made in protecting the environment, they were happening at a high point in workers' struggle as well. Workers who had spent years in bitter struggles to improve their lot, who had won a lot of victories for better wages and safety. And so they were confident and they wanted to shape the world in their own interests. And they were prepared to stand up to fight all kinds of injustices by flexing their industrial muscle and stomping on the boss's toes more than a bit. It was because workers had confidence in themselves that they wanted to fight in solidarity with others, that they knew their own power and wanted to use it for good. So it's crucial, I think, to mention that the trailblazing unions that led the fights for equal pay in Australia, like the metal workers and the meat workers, they were majority male. And even in the industries that were 50% women or more, like, for example, like the insurance clerks union, it was important there that men also joined in the fight. And in that fight in the insurance clerks union, leading activists, they didn't want the campaign to involve or appeal only to women. They saw that, you know, to actually stand up to and fight and win a legal like definition of equal pay, it would take a lot more than just women workers. You'd actually need a lot more industrial strength than that. And many women, when you read about it, talked about how they were furious when the insurance union leaders, they kept trying to hold women-only meetings on equal pay. They kept trying to restrict the campaign for equal pay in that union to women only. And they would cross out the offending lines on union posters. And they demanded that their male co-workers attend the meetings and take the issue seriously. And in many of these fights, the leading rank and file activists were also socialists and communists who understood the need for united action. So the judiciary and the Labour Party under Gough Whitlam, it's just kind of seen as a fait accompli that they turned up in government and that's how we got equal pay. But the first equal pay case crucially involved mass strikes, and it granted equal pay for equal work in 1969. At the end of 23 years of uninterrupted Liberal Party rule. And this was before Whitlam was elected as well. So you can't say Whitlam gave us equal pay. The arbitration system and the government fought tooth and nail all the way along. And they only did what the bosses wanted until there was a sufficient level of struggle from our side to push them over the edge. And it took until 1973 to get an equal pay for work of equal value ruling. But bosses continued to reclassify and retitle workers' jobs. So they could dodge paying women more. As soon as there was like an equal pay for equal work, they just like changed the titles of women's jobs and so on. And unions were required to ask to have the test case ruling apply to workers in their industry. And different unions achieved different results. There were those that took a legalistic approach, and there were those that had militant rank and filers who pushed for industrial action to win equal pay. And two guesses, which strategy won better pay faster. So oppression for the most of the time can work to, oh, well, this is just a really cool photo. Like there's all, not that many survive, but really cool photos of the first protests and so on for equal pay. So oppression can work most of the time to keep people in their place, but at times it can scrape up sparks that can light up mass resistance. And part of that is about what tinder is around, if I can stretch the metaphor further. How conscious are the wider layers in society of their oppression? How fed up are they? How desperate are they? Have they had a recent history of their struggles that went down to defeat? Are there new cohorts in the workforce who are busting to push past the old conservative leaders and who are readying the barricades as we speak? All of these things play a role. And underconfidence, I think it's important to point out, can also transform into explosive anger almost overnight. Just think of the leading role women have played in the revolution in Sudan recently, the leading role of the women textile workers in Myanmar in the movement against the military coup, and the massive protests across the world after the Roe versus Wade decision ripped up abortion rights for millions. And precisely because women's oppression is so inescapable and central to capitalism's functioning, their struggles can have a widespread impact and drive large-scale resistance. And it's that energy and militancy that we need to bring back today. Nothing else will do. The scale of the destruction that capitalism poses before us is literally planet-ending. Understanding the twin basis of women's oppression is crucial to understanding how capitalism works and needs to be the basis of our perspective as we fight to smash this sick system.